my pleasure this evening to introduce the first distinguished visiting fellow of the Chester Ronnie Center, Professor Roger Hutchinson. And this evening he is giving the Augustana Distinguished Lecture, which is made possible for us to do through the generosity of the Hendrickson Family Endowment. And we have Joyce with us this evening. Wonderful that the Hendrickson family has made it possible for so many good things to take place in Camrose and elsewhere. Professor Roger Hutchinson is a son of Camrose, Duhamel, actually, just next door. Right? A suburb, I believe.
Camrose is close to Duhamel.
Duhamel is the center of the world. His first degree was in engineering, and he spent 5 years in the oil industry here in Alberta. And since I first met Roger, that has helped me understand how this wonderful public intellectual has been able, often, continuously, in many areas, to hold together the compelling arguments and ideas that come from what are often seen to be competing perspectives, and to work with people around the table holding those distinct perspectives and seeking to have them deepen their understanding, come to a more modest understanding of what it is they really can illuminate from those perspectives, and find some ways to work together for the life of our fragile world. Roger went off to study ethics and religion at the University of Chicago, that great school, and then on to Toronto, and took up a position at Emmanuel College in the University of Victoria, University of the University of Toronto, for many, many years, has taught, I suppose, two, virtually three generations of both scholars and public intellectuals and activists who have contributed enormously to Canadian society and to our understanding of a whole range of issues. I'm delighted that he has come to spend the month of September with us, to work in Camrose and here in Edmonton, a bit in Calgary, and then on finally to Winnipeg. There is a newsletter of the Ronnie Center sitting over there, as well as a fall schedule, and you will see in both of those the series of things that are being laid on for September. And I'll say just a little bit more before we finish this evening about things specifically here in Edmonton. So I'm delighted to invite Roger to give the 2008 Augustana Distinguished Lecture on doing ethics in a pluralistic society. Every time we pick up the paper, these issues are staring us in the face. So I'm delighted you're here, and welcome.
Well, it's indeed an honor to be here tonight as the Chester Ronning Center's visiting scholar and a guest of Robertson Wesley United Church. I'd like to thank David, wherever he went, and the Hendrickson family and their generous endowment, and other members of the Augustana community who have made Moira and me feel so welcome in Camrose. And I'd like to thank Jim Allen and the Robertson Wesley community for generously hosting this lecture. And I'm pleased and somewhat intimidated to see members of my family here. And I look forward to hearing your views on the topic after I have made some comments about doing ethics in a pluralistic world. Now, my movement from one aspect of this topic to another will be like plowing or swathing a field. Sometimes, like swathing, now I was restudying this metaphor as we drove from Camrose to Edmonton, and I realized that my image of swathing predated self-propelled swathers. Anyway, my metaphor is that, like swathing, we go round and round. But sometimes, like plowing, we go back and forth. And as I recall from the days before farmers used global positioning systems, in order to plow the first furrow, it was necessary to find a fixed object on the far horizon that would give a good straight first furrow. Occasionally, however, it turned out that that object on the horizon wasn't fixed at all. It was moving like a grazing cow. So that could create an interesting pattern. But it didn't work very well for plowing the whole field. So our conversations about ethical issues in pluralistic contexts usually involve both moving targets and trying to straighten out our claims and arguments. The fixed point on the horizon for the way I do ethics is improved communication. The challenge is how we talk to one another about important issues in spite of or in the midst of our differences. Conversations can go on and on, but we know that we are moving toward the center when we reach a point of decision and action, or when we know it's time to move on to a different field. Now, whether you prefer plowing or old-fashioned swathing as an image for conversation, you'll notice that my discussion of pluralism and doing ethics will seem to be going back and forth and round and round. My initial focus in the talk will be on pluralism itself and how we understand that. And I'll describe various stages of the transition from Anglo-Saxon Protestant dominance to a more pluralistic respect for differences in religion and culture. I will include reflection on the way in which my own increased awareness of pluralism and my own increased awareness of different voices reflecting ethnic, religious, and other forms of diversity, in fact, influenced my way of doing ethics. When I initially submitted a description for this lecture, I was preoccupied with the extent to which we now inhabit a world that seems to be more pluralistic than the world of our parents or even our own world in earlier ages. And then I thought about what it was actually like growing up in Duhamel and going to school in New Norway. There was certainly diversity. I grew up knowing that our Roman Catholic neighbors didn't eat meat on Fridays. I also knew that our Catholic neighbor kids didn't buy candy during Lent. But I also noticed that they put the money they might have spent on candy into a jar and had a real binge when Lent was over. Now, in our district, there were obvious differences within our Protestant religion as well. When a Pentecostal neighbor, Mrs. Swanson, used to lead Bible studies and preach in our New Norway school, I would take my turn reading the Bible. But I was also a little bit jealous of the Catholic students who were out playing ball because they got excused from these Protestant religious services. And also I can recall when Mrs. Swanson would invite us to come forward in an altar call to be saved, that we would stay rooted in our seats. Our parents, Connie will remember, our parents had assured us that we didn't really need to do that because that wasn't our way. But as a good liberal United Church person, I was never really quite sure what our way was. But we knew that diversity existed in our community because Pentecostals and United Church were different from one another. So we reflected the fact of diversity, but I'm really not sure how hard we worked at trying to understand one another's theology. Another form of diversity was reflected by our neighbors who lived to the east of us along the Battle River. The Labakans and the Redingers were what we would at that time called half-breeds. And I knew that there must be some connection between the fact that their people were really interested in land that ran down to the river and the fact that our farm was on these long, narrow strips of land that led down to the river. I learned later that our land was on river lots, which is a section of Alberta surveyed in accordance with that wish. So there was a kind of glimmer of intercultural understanding lying behind that, but not very close to our consciousness. So our Pentecostal, French Catholic, English Catholic, Métis, German, and Ukrainian neighbors represented diversity, but whether or not there was genuine pluralism, understood as mutual respect among different religions and cultures, is less certain. For example, our German neighbors had a tough time of it during the war and shortly after the war. Ukrainians, especially up around Hay Lakes, were different from us, but surely they were just on the way to becoming more and more like us. Part of my own awakening to the difference between the fact of diversity and the goal of pluralism as mutual respect came to me one time when I referred to Ukrainians as garlic snappers. And it turned out I was out with a Ukrainian person. And she said, "What's wrong with garlic? I love it." Well, as someone raised in a nice Anglo-Saxon Protestant home, I'd never tasted garlic. But I now, having married an Irish Catholic, an Irish Anglican, I love garlic. But that was a sobering reminder that there were certain terms in my vocabulary that I had to get rid of. So, while I was growing up, I was aware to some extent of religious and ethnic differences. But for persons with my background, the fixed point on the horizon that defined where Canadian society had come from and where it ought to be going continued to be the Anglo-Saxon Protestant version of an earlier generation. So, to understand how things have changed, it might be useful to recall the stages we've passed through, or we are passing through, on our way from Anglo-Saxon Protestant dominance to what I would hope to be a more pluralistic society. I will comment on three approaches to, or theories about, Canadian society. The first is Anglo-conformity that I've just mentioned, and I hope that's mostly in the past. The second is secularization and multiculturalism. And the third is pluralism and interculturalism. And I'll try to explain those. So a review of these stages or approaches will provide the background for a brief introduction to the comparative ethics method that my students and colleagues and I have been developing over the past decades, developing a way to do ethics in a pluralistic society. First, Anglo-conformity. As an example of the Anglo-conformity agenda for British North America, it's hard to beat Lord Durham's 1938 report on relations between French Catholic and English Catholic Protestants or provinces. And the sentiments expressed by Lord Durham in his report would also have been applied at that time to First Nations peoples and other ethnic and religious groups. Lord Durham recommended the union of Upper and Lower Canada in the hope that the French population of Lower Canada would be, these are his words, that they would be elevated to a thoroughly British character. As he pointed out, the aim of such a nation would be in part, and again, these are his words, the aim would be to merge the petty jealousies of a small community and the odious animosities of origin in the higher feelings of a nobler and more comprehensive nationality. Lord Durham's references to odious animosities of origins and the higher feelings of a nobler, more comprehensive nationality provide an extreme and, for an Anglophone Protestant, an embarrassing reminder of the earlier Anglo-superiority assumptions. Unfortunately, the shift from an explicit agenda of Anglo-conformity and immigrant adjustment through secularization did not mean the end of Anglo-superiority assumptions. Such assumptions did not disappear, they simply became less visible. The term secularization usually refers to the way in which the public realm has become or should be thoroughly secular, that is, without religious interference or influence, while religion has been reduced to a purely private matter. Now, I contend that a more adequate understanding of what it means to talk about a secular society is that there is no longer a single dominant religious tradition. The public realm is and should be both shared and contested. And this is the meaning of intercultural that I'll talk more about a little later. So, the unhelpful version of secularization that reduces religion to a private matter was well illustrated in a somewhat old study now, but it's still a relevant study of the assimilation of various minority groups on the prairies by the Canadian sociologist Carl Dawson. Dawson studied the assimilation of Doukhobors, Mennonites, Mormons, German Catholics, and French Canadians during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Now, whereas Lord Durham believed that minority groups ought to be assimilated as part of a plan to create a British Protestant society, Dawson shifted the attention away from intentions and values of people like Lord Durham, from what people think ought to happen, to simply what had happened. As you look back on it, what had happened and why? As a scientist, he tried to explain how the language, religion, and culture of minorities had become purely private matters. The outcome, he thought, wasn't planned. It was nobody's intention. It just happened that way. Now, with hindsight, ethicists specialize in hindsight. Scientists specialize on just explaining what happened. We tend to be more curious about why things happened and who was wanting what outcome. With hindsight, we can see Dawson's blind spots. He explained the assimilation of minority groups by referring to natural forces at work in the prairie environment. He simply reported on what he believed to be the inevitable assimilation of pre-modern traditional societies into a religiously neutral modern secular society. I would suggest that a more adequate explanation of what happened is that, to use the German Catholic community as an example, I would just suggest that a more adequate explanation is that the German Catholic communities failed to survive not because assimilation was a natural force at work in the prairie environment, but because somebody decided where the railroads were going to run. They decided that the railroads would run in a straight line rather than through the German Catholic communities. So new commercial towns with English-speaking government services, grain elevators, equipment dealers, they're the communities that attracted the young people and the small businesses away from the church-centered villages and away from the traditions and authority of German-speaking parents, teachers, and church leaders. Now, decisions about where the railroad would run and where the new commercial towns would be located might have reflected rational policies, but they certainly were not simply the outcome of the play of natural forces. So Dawson, we can see, was an early proponent of what is now the widely accepted version of secularization theory. According to this theory, the public realm is without religious influence or interference, and religion and culture are purely private matters. Now, this was fine for the Anglo-Saxon Protestant majority, at least in the early years, because the continuing dominance of our religion and language and culture was simply taken for granted. And our Anglo-Saxon Protestant identity was not threatened. Now, one might assume that the next logical step along the way from Anglo-conformity through secularization towards pluralism would be multiculturalism. Now, it might seem slightly un-Canadian of me to criticize multiculturalism, but I'm going to have to run that risk. I'm critical of the early form of multiculturalism reflected in the 1971 Multiculturalism Act and in the writings of Pierre Trudeau. I'm critical of them for the same reason I criticize Dawson's assumptions about secularization. You'll all recall the 1971 Multiculturalism Act was in part a response to the Royal Commission on bilingualism and biculturalism. The shift in terms from bilingualism and biculturalism to bilingualism and multiculturalism was based on the understanding that although Canada is a bilingual nation with two official languages, we do not have a single dominant religion or culture. So far, so good. But the weakness of this position is that the gain made by minorities by this recognition of diversity was linked to an important limiting condition. This understanding of multiculturalism was characterized by a taken-for-granted separation between public and private realms. Like the secularization theory, it was assumed that the public realm should be religiously neutral and secular, while religious and cultural differences should be confined to the private realms of church, synagogue, mosque, ethnic restaurants, and folk dancing. Now, a leading spokesperson for the idea that the public realm is religiously and culturally neutral and free from the emotional baggage of particular religious, ethnic, or nationalist emotions was Pierre Trudeau. He dismissed the views of Quebec nationalists in part by claiming that the separatist counter-revolution is the work of a powerless, these are his words, it's the work of a powerless petty bourgeois minority afraid of being left behind by the 20th century revolution. The leaders of this movement are not prepared to carve out a place for themselves in the modern world by ability. Rather, they want to make the whole tribe return to the wigwams by declaring their independence. You can see why Trudeau was not a big hero of the nationalist movement in Quebec. Trudeau's understanding of multiculturalism reflected the same assumptions about secularization that we saw in Carl Dawson. The problem is not Trudeau's emphasis on rationality, but the arrogance of his assumption that ethnic loyalties and nationalist commitments of others can be reduced to private, subjective, pre-modern emotions. Trudeau perpetuated the unhelpful notion that a secular public realm should be free from the entanglements of religious and ethnic loyalties, rather than a shared space where such differences are discussed openly and rigorously with persons with different religious and cultural backgrounds and commitments. Well, I have one more example of this secularization theory. This was reflected in a Globe and Mail article during the early days of Stockwell Day's political career. Jeffrey Simpson, in an article in the Globe, called his article, "Leave the Prayer Book at Home, Stockwell." Simpson argued that in this secular country, Mr. Day should not bring his religious beliefs into the public realm. This is Simpson's language. That might have been acceptable 100 years ago. When religion infused itself into all kinds of Canadian political debates. But he said, now, however, a curtain has been drawn between the religious and the secular, between the private world of religion and the public world of politics. According to Simpson, issues such as abortion, family values, and sexuality have been settled by courts and legislatures. No room anymore for religious involvement in those debates. Now, just an aside here, unfortunately, so I've done a downer on the secularization theory that treats the public realm as religiously neutral and religion as a private value. The other side of the problem is that the possibility of a shared, contestable public realm is also undermined when minority group positions are presented as being non-negotiable or non-debatable. That's the flip side of the coin. There are two challenges to pluralistic, open debate in the public realm. Kind of invites a discussion of the notion of reasonable accommodation, but that's a topic for another day. I just want at this point to make the point that a third way is needed. We need to move beyond secularism, defined as no religion in the public realm, and fundamentalism, meaning my religion. In fact, most liberal and conservative churches agree in their rejection of the idea that religion has no place in the public realm. Most also accept the fact that they share that public realm with one another, with members of other religions, and with persons who have no formal religious affiliation. The question is, how is that public realm shared? If religious voices neither aspire to dominate the shared public space, nor accept the reduction of religious beliefs and values to merely private matters, what are some of the strategies for promoting good conversations and a pluralistic respect for diversity? That's the next step on our pilgrimage from secularization and multiculturalism to pluralism and what I'm going to be calling interculturalism. I'll illustrate what I mean by pluralism and interculturalism by describing an early example of the participation of a multi-faith coalition in public policy discussions. The Ontario Interfaith Social Assistance Reform Commission was created in 1986 to participate in the work of the government's Social Assistance Review Committee and to bring faith group perspectives on the issue of poverty into the public realm. Each sponsoring organization provided its own words and its own reasons for being involved in such social reform activities. For Jews, the Jews said, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." For Muslims, "No one of you is a believer until he believes for his brother what he desires for himself." Until he desires for his brother what he desires for himself. For Christians, "Love your neighbor as yourself." For Buddhists, "Hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful." For Unitarian Universalists, "Affirm the worth and dignity of every person." Well, you can see that each of the faith communities, in one way or another, were reaffirming some version of the "do unto others as you would have others do unto you," the golden rule. The work of the coalition continues today and is carried out in ways that illustrate three aspects of what I'm calling pluralism and interculturalism. The first, each faith group accepted the fact that its own special teachings are not authoritative for everyone. But they were also able to identify a set of values shared by members of other traditions, as well as by persons with no formal religious affiliation. Second, the diverse range of faith groups rejected the secularization argument that, as Jeffrey Simpson had said, a curtain had been drawn between the public realm of secular scientific argument and the religious realm of stressing values and commitments. They rejected that. They rejected the idea that the curtain had been drawn between the private world of religion and the public world of politics. They felt both free and motivated to speak out as Jews, as Christians, as Muslims, as Buddhists. The third point, finally, but when it came to proposing particular reforms, the faith groups were prepared to translate their distinctive ways of looking at a particular issue into shared public language. Now, it's that task, the task of translating confessional language into shared public language, that I will discuss further by talking about the early stages of attempts to develop an approach to religious ethics in a public university context consisting of students from a wide range of religious backgrounds. Now, it was my experience of teaching ethics and religious studies with students and colleagues with different religious identities that helped to bring about my own conversion from multiculturalism to interculturalism. This transition was also characterized, as I think back on going to professional meetings and talking to one another about what our profession, what our discipline was, there was, over those years, there was a transition from the language of Christian ethics and religious ethics to comparative ethics as a way of describing our academic discipline. Now, for persons familiar with the Intercultural Dialogue Project of the University of Alberta's Faculty of Education, or for those of you familiar with the United Church's current emphasis on becoming an intercultural church, the term interculturalism will be a familiar concept. But for many of us, it won't be immediately clear how interculturalism relates to multiculturalism. The view I'm defending is that multiculturalism, as the term multi suggests, focuses on the fact of diversity, while interculturalism shifts the emphasis to encounters among persons and groups with cultural differences. Interculturalism also stresses the importance of culture as an important aspect of our public identities, as an important ingredient in our conversations with one another. You'll recall that I criticized Lord Durham for his failure to respect French-Canadian culture. He reflected a one-sided assimilationist view with no interest in mutual respect or dialogue. And in a closely related way, Carl Dawson, Pierre Trudeau, and Jeffrey Simpson, while they acknowledged the fact of diversity, they thought that cultural differences and religious matters were simply private matters. So proponents of interculturalism take a different view. They go beyond the fact of diversity and stress the importance of encounters in both private and public realms among persons with different religions, cultures, and political views. So a moment on my own early struggles with doing ethics in what was immediately obvious to me, a very diverse and culturally rich classroom. When I began teaching religious studies at the University of Toronto, my first class was a large class called Contemporary Problems in Religious Ethics. It was made up of conservative and liberal Protestants and Catholics, made up of a third of the class would have no religious affiliation, and there were some Buddhists and some Jewish students. Now, at that time, this is 1970, in 1969, the Criminal Code amendments had just legalized abortion, and the church had been actively involved on both sides of the debate. And this seemed like a very challenging issue for a Protestant Catholic classroom. So, especially during the early 70s, abortion was certainly a contemporary problem with definite religious implications. Now, abortion was not the only issue that we dealt with, but it certainly provides an early illustration of the challenge of pluralism that I experienced in that classroom. It was clear to me that as an instructor in a religious studies department in a public university, I did not have a mandate to provide instruction in the most academically sound judgments about the ethics of abortion. Now, I must say that was still true 2 decades later when I shifted from the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Toronto to the denominationally diverse Toronto School of Theology. And I would say in my own classes in the United Church's Theological College, it was as important to recognize diversity in those settings as it had been in the public university. So I interpreted my mandate not as one of providing instruction in the right way to view these issues, but in both the religious studies and theological contexts, my mandate was to help students to think clearly and rigorously about the claims and arguments being presented by different participants in the debate. The main challenge was how to honor different voices, different experiences, and different religious identities without simply reducing all ethical claims to private opinions. So that you could just say, well, you've got your way of looking at it, I've got mine. How do you retain the rigor and respect the diversity? The key to this learning was the recognition that in our everyday language and in our more disciplined ethical and philosophical discourses, we use different types of claims and arguments. Some of these claims we simply report. We confess as our own way of telling our stories. But how we apply these confessed beliefs in debates about public policies are subjected to the scrutiny of others. We are called to give reasons for the conclusions we draw from our basic religious beliefs. And it's especially important to feel subject to the scrutiny of the others who don't agree with you. It's no challenge. Ecumenical and interfaith debate has been a breeze when you just talk to people who agree with you. It's talking to people who disagree. This is what's meant by intercultural dialogue. No particular culture or set of religious teachings is simply taken for granted as binding on everyone. We engage in dialogue to increase understanding of each other and to find whatever ground there might be that would help us move forward together. So as I've already mentioned, in the discipline of ethics, there are different levels of clarification and that can be subjected to different kinds of scrutiny. A starting point for discussions in a class would always be to encourage the students to tell their own stories or to notice the general orientations and background stories of the authors or speakers being studied, and then to think about their own initial response to those perspectives. But as we shared our stories and initial responses, it would become clear that claims were being made about the facts that could be checked against empirical evidence. For example, a study showing that following an abortion, women experience depression. These studies were examined in relation to evidence that many other women experience postpartum depression after they've given birth. In the next stage of ethical clarification, more narrowly defined ethical concerns were examined in relation to claims about and facts and arguments based on rights and consequences. For example, persons opposed to abortion use a combination of claims about facts and claims about rights. From their point of view, human life begins at conception, and unborn babies have a right to life. On the other hand, defenders of a woman's right to choose a safe legal abortion have different beliefs about fetal development and a different assessment of the rights claims of fetuses and pregnant women. There were also conflicting claims about the consequences of making abortion legal or illegal. For some, the legalization of abortion would lead to other forms of disrespect for life. I remember one speaker in the class saying, once we legalize abortion, it'll only be a matter of time before frail grandparents are being taken out of their misery. And they'd be victims of mercy killings. For others, if women were denied safe legal abortions, they would resort to unqualified abortionists, and this would result in suffering and deaths resulting from botched abortions. Now, in a further stage of ethical clarification, we examined how our reports about religious beliefs and our claims about facts, rights, and consequences provide the framework within which disciplined discussion could take place amongst persons with differing views. In the end, an intercultural approach to doing ethics in a pluralistic world involves conversations that go back and forth and round, involving the various levels of clarification. Such conversations combine respect for differences in culture and religious identity with, on the one hand, rigorous attention to the validity of claims about facts, attention to the persuasiveness of claims and arguments about rights, attention to claims about consequences, and attention to what finally for various people the issue symbolizes or means in terms of their basic stories. Now, doing ethics in a pluralistic world also involves paying attention to language, especially to the language that is usually simply taken for granted. So to illustrate this point, I'll draw on an experience I had with an interfaith group drafting a shared statement related to environmental ethics. In the early 1990s, I was involved in preparations for the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, UNCTAD, held in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. As part of those preparations, both Moira and I attended a meeting of religious groups brought together by the World Council of Churches. The task of the group was to provide an interfaith statement that would become part of the international effort to prepare an earth charter for the UN conference. So as we worked on this shared document, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim participants automatically used the language of creation and creator. What we were about was, how do we respect creation? At one point, a Buddhist participant from Thailand gently reminded us that if we use the language of creator and creation, she would have to return to Thailand and say, "I attended this really neat meeting of Jews and Muslims and Christians, and it was a good time, but it wasn't the resulting statement was not my statement." As a Buddhist, the language of creator and creation was not her language. Now, interestingly enough, this Buddhist intervention released a surge of energy into the gathering. And we didn't think of it as reasonable accommodation, because we weren't simply deferring to the wishes of the Buddhist minority. The Christian, Jewish, and Muslim participants were deeply committed to producing an inclusive statement, what we would now call an intercultural statement. And we ended up deciding that the term One Earth Community could replace creation for the purposes of the interfaith statement. And it didn't represent a pulling back from the richer biblical language in order to achieve a more inclusive but shallower statement. It represented a going beyond exclusive language by infusing meaning into the new term. As one participant suggested, the symbol One Earth Community could function in relation to environmental rights the way that human dignity had provided a richer context for the human rights claims embodied in the 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights. The Buddhist colleague returned to Thailand convinced that she had been part of an intercultural conversation. And I was pleased when my own denomination, the United Church, adopted a policy statement later in the 90s drawing on the work of the interfaith group, and it was entitled One Earth Community, Ethical Principles for Environment and Development. Now, in these comments, I have been focusing primarily on the challenges of communication in a pluralistic world. The images of plowing and swathing back and forth or round and round must, of course, be complemented by paying attention to what goes on between cultivating the land and harvesting the crop. Doing ethics also involves participation in the planting of the seeds that will yield a future harvest of good conversations. There must also be careful attention to when one is plowing, one is planting, one is swathing, or one could go further and say running the combine, grinding the grain, baking the bread, serving the bread. The conversation goes round and round and back and forth. So the modest fare I've presented, to use my local food imagery, it's probably neither sufficiently local nor sufficiently nutritious. But I hope it will provide us some food for thought in our continuing conversation. Thank you.
Invite two of our colleagues here to come and think out loud a little bit around what Roger has had to say for a few minutes. So first I'd like to ask Carol Ann Inglis from this lovely church to think out loud a little bit about what she has heard and what she would like to pursue with Roger.
Okay, I feel like I'm out of it in terms of words because I hadn't really thought about interculturalism. The words keep changing, talking about that moving target. That's one of the words that keeps changing. I thought I'd made progress when I was sort of coping with pluralism. So now this interculturalism, it's an interesting way to think of the people of Canada, at least, and how we have to relate to one another. The ethical issues seem to be such huge stumbling blocks. Like, I'm wondering if we ever can come to, how do we come to consensus? How do we make some rules that we can all live by when we have all these different points of view? Like, I just see us becoming immobilized. Yet things do seem to get done, and we keep changing. But I'm sort of curious of how you think that we can actually make progress, like make some decisions, and come together and respect one another in our different points of view, but yet have some rules that we can live by. In the midst of this election, of course, then that's that's part of what's there. It's also part of it was fascinating. I didn't hear much of it, but there's been some replaying of some of the service for Larry Chabon, who was a Muslim and a politician in Alberta, and it was really amazing to listen to some of those stories around his influence on our province and his quiet way of being a very strong Muslim, but yet be having a great influence in our community. And now I'm curious, how did he ever become part of the things that made the laws that we can actually live by? I don't know. Can you respond to any of that?
That's a good question. And I think a very short answer is that we need to create the occasions when we talk to one another and discover both the nature of our differences. Do we have really differences about policies? But were we also, in the process of that conversation, discover that there really are some important things that we have in common? So that when I use the example of the Interfaith Social Action Reform Committee, to work together to say what together we want to do to try and get a better deal in Ontario for people in poverty, they had to spend some time together and say, well, you know, we all really do believe that we should care about the people who are presently suffering by the way things work. We really do believe that deeply rooted in our traditions is this concern that we should treat others the way... So they weren't just at sea, and it wasn't just everything wasn't up for grabs. They said, we're really anchored in those. Then to say, does that mean we need more in government involvement in the economy or more trust in the market? Well, that opens out onto other faith stories. What do you have faith in? But I think the main thing is to create those occasions for conversation so we can both bring into focus our differences, but also against the bedrock of some pretty deeply shared values. That's what I would say.
Do you see, Roger, that the kind of fear that Caroline was talking about, with the kind of extraordinary pluralism that exists, the kind of fear that all of this can destabilize, and that maybe there is nothing you refer to it as laws or some kind of commonly held principle? Do you see the conversation that you speak about, bringing people to the table? See that as the antidote to the
fear,
as a point of departure?
Well, it is, in the sense, to the extent that people who have those experiences do in fact discover that they have common values. But I do think, you know, as an engineer who became a theologian, I can take pot shots at philosophers. And I think we haven't been helped by some of our ways of thinking that says once you remove from me the claim that my truth is absolute truth, all truth is relative. And I think they're just more useful ways of thinking about how we actually relate to one another. That you can say, gee, I grew up just taking for granted that that was the way things were. Now I go away to school and I meet all these other people and things that are different, but it doesn't mean that what you held before was valueless, or that there's no basis on which to say what do I hold on to and what do I let go. But I think that we cultivate that ability to discern what we hang on to and what we let go through actual discussions and through and in picking one spot. I mean every group that meets isn't the group that you want to belong to.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because if you hadn't, I probably would have. Because one of the things I've also discovered is that globally there seems to all be, in some communities, a retrenchment to more fundamental positions. Yep. So on the one hand, you've got groups that are, you know, retrenching, going back, trying to find their religious roots. Yep. With people in our Western society who have no way of talking to them or understanding where they're going. One of the things that I'm in the military, and I was in Afghanistan a couple of years ago. We were working in the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, and all those concepts are quite important. Mm-hmm. For many of our soldiers, it came as a surprise that religion and culture and society couldn't be separated in the blocks.
Right.
That being Muslim and being was something completely foreign to them, because they'd been brought up in a secular society where religion was something you did on Sunday mornings privately or someplace else on Saturday or Friday, and kept that to yourself.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where I see a real difficulty with the discussion, and it's partly, and how do we pick up on that language? Equip ourselves so that we can talk to people for whom religion is part of. who they are totally.
Yep. Yeah, and we've talked about this before, but it's particularly a problem in a society where persons who gravitate toward a more liberal live-and-let-live religious stance and whose values are then reflected in the mainstream culture, then they no longer articulate where they stand as a religious stance. So if you read our newspapers or you listen to our public discussion, the only religion on the go is the absolutizing kind of religion. So in some ways, the challenge I'm issuing is for more liberal persons and persons without formal religious affiliation to cultivate the ability to say where they're coming from and what kind of core values would undergird their views and become part of the conversation. Don't sit back and say, oh, I hate those religious types because they're so certain. Yeah. I'm not saying that to you, but yeah. But you see, when I started teaching at the University of Toronto in 1969-70, the students who had just come out of 13 years of Catholic schooling were almost in that situation of never really having thought about what it would look like to see the issue from another point of view. And I had evangelical students with a strong biblical set of beliefs were in about the same boat. So it wasn't easy, but over a term, you wouldn't say, you know, you'll flunk if you don't get onto this. But it was interesting how in the actual experience of hearing others express their views, they would come to say, gee, you know, I can see where you're coming from without having to abandon where I'm coming from. See, the challenge in religious studies has been to not to be too quick to baptize them and say, oh, well, you're religious after all. I mean, there really is a challenge to get persons who are two or three generations away from a religious upbringing to articulate their position so you don't prematurely drag them back into the camp. Yeah.
Guard against that.
The tactic that was used, I don't know how well it was followed up on, but the at one point in our various kinds of meetings, one of our Buddhist colleagues came up with the idea of an Earth Charter portfolio. So that on the one hand, we worked a way to get an interfaith statement, but it was accompanied by statements from each of the religious traditions saying, here's why we held out for that language, here's why we rejected that kind of language. So ideally, just as in a judge's decision, you both read the judge's findings and you read the reasons of the judges for why they made the finding they did. Bertha Wilson insisted that the persons all give their reasons, even if they agreed with one another, they give their reasons. And so that retained some of the richness of you didn't just collapse the positions into this very general statement. You retained the richness of where that statement came from.
Is your concern that a variety of perspectives coming from different places dumbs down any attempt to come to some kind of common ground? Is that your concern?
No, my concern was after you've done all that, will everyone understand in the same way? There'll be a common consensus.
What if they understand in a deeper way differently? Is that a possibility too?
Oh, yes.
In that circumstance?
No, I mean, your point is really well taken, and it challenges us in terms of working on issues and trying to influence public policy, and you arrive at general statements. You arrive at general statements that those of us who have too much should have less, so that those who have less have enough, Then you come home and they find out, they say, well, we've taken your yard to use as a community garden, because that's what we meant when we said those who have too much. And so,
Bruce, would you like to speak to this a bit?
Yes, well, if there's so much I could talk about, I really appreciate your coming, Roger. And as a matter of fact, we met 1970 at a really important conference for me in Regis College in Toronto, which featured Gibson Winter. And I know Roger studied with Gibson Winter at the University of Chicago, and I went to University of Chicago to study with Gibson Winter in 1973. So we have a lot in common. You're very brave coming to Alberta, thinking that it's easy for you to take on Pierre Trudeau in Alberta. But I'm a liberal.
Was he?
Well, he was elitist liberal. I really liked your presentation. I think that we could debate at length the secularization thesis. I agree that, you know, it's a concept that needs to be challenged, and you know, it's a kind of concept that dies a death of a thousand qualifications, because there, you know, there's different theories and so on. But when you compare the traditional world out of which we come with the modern world, there's still something to it, because obviously so much has changed. And you know, whereas in traditional societies, for example, economics was always a subsystem, and there was a kind of sacred canopy that, you know, was overarching. In modern age, it's economics that is the overarching sacred canopy, and religion has become a religion of the private sphere. So I tend to appreciate, to a certain extent, the secularization thesis. And also, when it comes to the defining what is the public, and what kind of language, what kind of arguments, what kind of rules of engagement, if you like, are to take place in the public realm, I think we have to go back even to the Enlightenment and say, well, given the religious wars in Europe, it was important, I think, for politics and legislatures to move ahead and want to have a different kind of language, different kind of rules of discussion based on something called reason or rationality. Now, I need to quickly say something about that, because my most recent experience of a legislature didn't lead me to believe that rationality or reason reigns, especially in the Alberta legislature. And I think maybe your distinction between public and private actually applies to a split within the public. Because on one hand, you have a concern to get the facts and have scientific experts provide information. On the other hand, most legislators don't even pay attention to that kind of information and just speak out and make a statement which comes down to almost a statement of faith. So, for example, we argued about affordable housing all night in the legislature last year. And, you know, I thought we had all the evidence. We had the scientific studies and sociological studies to make our case. About 4 o'clock in the morning, I came to the conclusion that the government side really doesn't care about the facts at all. I'm reminded, just a couple of days ago, I came across a great quote of George Bush, George Bush Sr., who, when the American warship shot down an Iranian Airbus and killed 299 people, George Bush said, "I'm not going to apologize for the United States of America. I don't care about the facts."
I don't care about the facts, yeah.
And so in the middle of this discussion on affordable housing, suddenly the other side, the government side, started saying things like, well, we can't allow any government to interfere in the market. No, we can't have rent controls because we can't have the government interfere. The market is God. And as if they don't interfere in the market and other issues, like the tar sands. But anyway, so here you have on the one hand, an attention to experts. And by the way, your book on the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline is great on this, right? You have attention to studies, the experts, the scientific experts, who are supposedly neutral, but of course they're not. They're it's interested. I mean, it depends whether your studies are from the Parkland Institute or the Fraser Institute, right? On the other hand, you have these statements that politicians make that everybody's just supposed to bow down and accept. You know, as religious belief, the market is God. The market is where it's at. So where does that leave us? As a religious person, then, coming into the legislature, I mean, there's an opening there. If it's just a question of belief, then, of course, we can talk about other beliefs. We can talk about other values. And I did the best I could, you know, to raise that issue. But, of course, you don't engage in actual theology in the legislature. So here's where the secularization thesis makes sense to me, is that I don't know whether it's an acceptance of the rules of engagement should be based on rationality. It's just that there's a kind of acceptance of it's customary for legislators to talk. They can talk about values. You can talk about your own personal past, your life, and so on. But you don't quote scripture. So I agree with Jeffrey Simpson, I think, that Stockwell Day should leave his prayer book at home. Because if to quote scripture...
Just make a theological critique. I mean, you said that the point of your opponents in the legislature was that they assumed the market was divine.
Yeah, but I can engage them in an argument and talk about a value set that's totally different from their value set, and make a real passionate plea for that policies should be based on a different set of values. But no, I wouldn't say that in the House. I think that there is a kind of customary acceptance of that we're all religious people. Some don't think they are, but we have our religious basis for arguments. But that's not what you appeal to in the legislature, in this particular space of the public. Maybe on Rutherford's show, I might go further, but that's another kind of space, the media. I think we have a little more freedom, maybe, to talk about our religious past and our theology. But no, I just don't think. I mean, this gets back to the issue of there are a lot of fundamentalists, and there were a few in the House, and I actually was happy that. We had a private members bill that was clearly an anti-abortion bill, and we had another one that was trying to undermine same-sex marriage. But I was thankful that the right-wing proponents did not engage in theological arguments on the floor of the House. So there is a dividing line. There is a line here. I'm trying to search and find out from Roger what you think that line is. So for example, if you quote a scripture, what you're doing is you're appealing to authority, right? Well, that's not an argument because not everybody shares that basis of authority. So I don't think that. The direction we should go into is, okay, let's hear all the religious voices. You have your scripture, I have mine. And I don't think in a public sphere, a political discussion, that's the way to go.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. The discourse in the legislature, in the court of law, is not unlike my class in a public university, that you don't directly invoke the authority of your religious tradition, as assuming that will end the debate. But on the other hand, if you think of the debate following the session, then I would tend to agree more with Bill Blakey when he said, you know, I don't have any problems with Stockwell Day citing the Bible, but I sure have problems with his understanding of Christianity. And so then you could imagine in a different setting having a different kind of debate, having then the more theological debate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you wouldn't say, you know, it's not fair for you to cite the Bible. But I do think that the rules of the game in the legislature would invite the translation into shared public language. I agree with that.
So I don't see it as an obstacle. Like if you want to make a case, I remember giving a private member statement where I used the term stewardship, you know, and you know, it's a really important biblical concept, but I didn't provide the biblical background for the members of the House. I simply said, you know, it's important that we are good stewards of the natural resources in this province. And the government, as a matter of fact, has abdicated its responsibility as a good steward. So it should step aside.
Right.
Anyway, that's
right.
And they did. And we are...
Oh, I can see how, you know, the last election, how far we got with that. Yes. Anyway.
Well, if I may push this just a touch further, because, you know, I'm inclined to do that. I'll try and frame it as a question. Do you think, is it the case for you, Bruce, I mean, given your being partial to the secularization view, has that, and as Roger has pointed out, that's a pretty characteristic of a large group of people in public service, and it has a long history, and we understand that. I wonder if it has made those who hold that view somewhat less capable of speaking to, and I will go for the language, speaking to the very idolatries that you deeply care about and that you spoke about here in a way that would, certainly in the legislature, in the public sphere, get one around or could have a potential to appeal to the people that you often consider the enemy. That is, in Alberta, if you could convince, if you could speak well in Alberta about the notion that the market is deity, mm-hmm. I cannot imagine, but I mean, a substantial number of evangelicals would have to ask themselves some questions.
Oh, yeah, no, I think, you know, I mean, to me, that's, I mean, I was taught that Alberta is open to the influence of a preacher. We sure have them in our past, right? Eberhardt and Manning, and it's still a potential is there for somebody to go around Alberta and hit the community leagues and just and yeah, exactly, and hammer away at the you know the commitment, the unbelievable commitment to destroying our environment and to being committed to unlimited economic growth that we see in Alberta. I mean, it's basically it's the kind of inquisitiveness that I think has been present actually from the beginning of Canadian society, but it seems to be especially here in Alberta for various reasons. So no, but that's, you see, that's a I'm talking about, and I think the Bouchard-Taylor report to the National Assembly in Quebec was really helpful because it defines that there are different kinds of public spaces. So for somebody to go on the sawdust trail and to preach in local community halls and so on about a new direction for Alberta and to be really prophetic about that, to be a social prophet, like, exactly, I think that's fine. That's I mean, or to go on Rutherford and talk about your conviction and why you're in favor of gay marriage. You know, he likes to debate that. But in the legislature, that's a different kind of public space. And I think that the Bouchard-Taylor report argues that way, that there are public institutions like legislatures that seem to have their own customs, their own language, their own ways of doing things. And we've developed a peculiar kind of democratic institution in Canada and U.S. and Britain and so on, which I think is good. And pluralism is a challenge to it, I think. Because, as you say, you know, there are lots of different voices. So how do we hear all those voices? Somebody mentioned Larry Chabot. You know, fantastic. He was a great minister in the Tory government as a Muslim. I mean, we, and in our caucus, we have a Muslim, a Mo Sally, who also lost in the last election. Sorry. But anyway, I think it is possible for those people to participate, to be true to their own religious background, but then to talk about values in a way that we can all understand, that we can all sort of, oh, hey, I'll go along with that. And so there's a coming together, consensus building, so on.
Thank you so much, Roger.
Thank you.
I'll just have a couple more things to say, and then we can have a little bit of meeting. Larry Chabot was mentioned, and just as a little reflection, which touches on some of these issues, for anyone who has historical memory in this part of the world, like almost literally in this part of the world, just down the street is the synagogue, they will know that when the two synagogues in Edmonton were built, people who contributed to those two synagogues, when you look at the list of contributions in the Jewish archive, you see a number of Muslim names. Why? Because they were competing together in business on Jasper Avenue. When you look at the list of names on who contributed to the building of El Rashid Mosque, you will notice there are a number of Jewish names. Why? For the same reason. People that compete together, people that live together, people that make a life together, have an enormous capacity to support each other. But of course, the terrors of history come along and destroy that periodically. I recall quite a number of years ago, when we had the ecumenical arsonist here in Edmonton, some of you will recall this, who in one night burned the shul, burned the Roman Catholic cathedral, a Nazarene church, an Alliance church, a Baptist church, and a United church. He was an ecumenical arsonist of the First Order. And when I heard this report on the news in the morning and I rode my bike to the museum, I stopped to see how Rabbi Saul Hyman was. Right over here at Beth Shalom Synagogue. Knocked on the door, the firemen were still working on the smoldering. And Saul came and opened the door and dissolved in tears. For the burning of a shul has more than one meaning to a Jew. And I held him in my arms for a period of time. And when he finally got control of himself, he said to me, "But David, something has happened. Something extraordinary has happened." This morning, at 6:30, there was a knock at the door. And I opened it, and who was there? Imam Shibli and Sabine Gannon. And Imam Shibli put his arms around me and said, "Another house of God has been burned. Please, Rabbi, please, come bring your congregation to El Rashid Mosque. You can worship in the basement." Three days later, I went to El Rashid Mosque. and Imam Shibli took me downstairs to show me the design of the new, it's not new any longer, the place from which, or where many Muslims worship now in the north side of Edmonton. And he showed it to me, and finally when I got his attention, I said, I came really to thank you for what you did, for that going to see the rabbi, and for that moment. And Imam Shibli said, oh, let me tell you what happened. He came back to the mosque. At the Friday noon prayer, he stood before the minbar, and he began to preach his sermon. And he told them that he and Salim Ghanem had gone to the shul, had told the Jewish community to come and worship in the mosque. And a number of young men came charging towards him, full of anger. And he whirled around the gifts of religious discipline, raised his arms in this first moment of prayer. No Muslim will interrupt them. So they all stood up and they prayed the rakas together. And when they had finished, he stood on the minbar and he said, and I tell you, we went there and we invited them to come here. And the young men rushed forward again, all in leather jackets. But they turned around, surrounding him. And they shouted down everybody else. And they said, our brothers, we are Palestinians. We know what it means not to do it the way it's been done here, the way the imam has acted. This is what we must do, what he has done. It is the fruit of relationship that this occurred. Because the rabbi and the imam had met each other in a public space and been able to speak in that public space out of what is best within both their traditions and experience. So, the conversation you invite us to is wonderful to hear about and to hear how that's developed for you and what its fruit can potentially be. So thank you so much, Roger, for